Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, we're doing something a little bit different today. My conversation with Sam Quiñones is really about what drives so many of the societal forces that we hear about but don't really always understand. Sometimes we need to be reminded how lucky we all are and how a lot of people don't have it as good as we do. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to The Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, we conclude our conversation with Sam Quiñones. If you didn't catch part one, we welcome you to give it a listen. And now, let's resume our time with Sam Quiñones. So I want to get back to fentanyl for a second because it has national implications. It has international implications. In fact, back in my little town here in Utah in 2016, two middle schoolers died because they ingested fentanyl that they'd gotten, I think they'd actually ordered from China, wherever it was. And then one of the police officers who responded to the call just touched the bag it was in, didn't even actually touch it itself, and had to be hospitalized. So talk about it. So for a long time, you know, China was pumping this stuff out and you could order it through the mail.
Right. China has produced fentanyl since the mid-80s when it signed an agreement with the guy who invented fentanyl. Paul Janssen, Belgian chemist, one of the great scientific minds of the 20th century, in my opinion. And they've been licensed. So a lot of companies now know how to make fentanyl. Well, as Chinese chemical companies realized what was going on in the United States, they began to market fentanyl online, sometimes on the dark web, which I still don't know how to get onto, and sometimes on the regular internet, but increasingly began to see, and they would ship it through the mail. They package it up, put it in some nondescript envelope and send, say, a pound or a quarter kilo, roughly, something like that, of fentanyl to dealers. Now, dealers in certain areas of the country were the first to figure this out. And those areas were the areas that first got into the opioid problem. Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, West Virginia, et cetera. That general area began to see all this fentanyl begin to come in 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, right in there. Begin to see these guys don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to mix fentanyl with other inert powders. They do it very badly. So you begin to see these big clusters in Cincinnati and Wheeling, West Virginia, big clusters of overdoses in a weekend, 50, 100, whatever it was. Akron is another place, very important in all this, Cleveland, et cetera. And then initially, Mexican traffickers were buying their fentanyl from these chemical companies. In time, they learned, though, how to make it. It's not hard, particularly one chemical in particular, 4-ANPP, can be transformed into fentanyl very easily, very much like ephedrine can be transformed into meth. They begin to learn how to do that. There are other chemicals they need to buy as well as time goes on. And gradually, the Mexican trafficking world learns how to do it, and more people down there learn how to make it. Can be done in the backyard. It's a very simple, low-tech production process.
Right. And then the Chinese start to crack down on the direct distribution of fentanyl, but not its component pieces.
Correct. This is the problem. China still sells those, Chinese companies, I should say, still sell those ingredients that you can use to make fentanyl. And now they're selling them to the Mexican trafficking world. And now that business in Mexico has exploded. And what you begin to see as that begins to happen is that fentanyl goes from being isolated in Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia, what have you. It goes to the east and west. It explodes both directions, east and west. And this is by 2017, 18, 19, for sure. Before COVID hit, we were essentially at national coverage of fentanyl. But with COVID, we're not recognizing. We have a worldwide pandemic on our hands. We're not paying attention to this. And so it begins to really intensify in just the entire country, really. It's very hard to find an area where there really isn't any fentanyl anymore. It's a historic thing. Think about this. First of all, we have never had one source, the Mexican trafficking world in this, Northwest Mexico, cover the country with one drug. Not even cocaine comes really close to the coverage that these two have are achieving as we speak. At the same time, drug historians used to talk about cycles of use, you know, stimulants to depressants to stimulants. You know, this would, each cycle would take like 15 years or whatever. Now you were seeing there's no more cycle. The supplies are so vast, so potent, that fentanyl and methamphetamine, the supplies have changed like historical trends. It's a remarkable idea, I think.
This is going to sound like an awful question. Is there a point at which this stuff becomes so deadly that it burns out its own users, that it's just not enough of a supply base? And it's a horrible question, and I hate to ask it, Sam.
No, but I think it's an excellent question. And I think, see, I hate to predict future. Reporters get into trouble when we try to do that too much. But I have to say, there must come a time when the drug combinations are so toxic that more and more people just stop using them. I'll be very interested to see if a trend that I'm seeing where we live here in Nashville among friends of my daughters, where they just don't use drugs. They don't really even use alcohol. I'm stunned at that, honestly.
Well, and that's a generational trend that I just had another author on board previously who said that, yeah, Generation Z, as they're called, they don't do drugs, they don't drink, they don't have sex, they don't really do much of anything, Sam. But that also, I think, speaks to your larger community problem, which is it's not really fun to get drunk by yourself.
Right? No, and it's also drugs are kind of contributing to that, because you can see, you know, when I first came out with The Least of Us, people literally said to me, oh, you're being alarmist. We've heard this before in the 30s or the 50s or the 60s and 70s. And I say, well, yeah, perhaps, but now it's true. All the myths that we used to invent about the horrors of dropping dead from one line of cocaine and that kind of thing, you know what I mean? Well, that's true now. People do drop dead from one line of cocaine because cocaine has fentanyl. And all of the myths have become reality. And that is a remarkable, scary idea. But on the other hand, I do believe that maybe this is having some kind of therapeutic positive effect, that people are understanding they can no longer really do in a risk-free way any recreational drug, because you can no longer trust any drug that's given to you to not contain fentanyl. And that's a remarkable idea.
I want to get to the good stories. But before that, I want to do one last piece, which is, and this contributes a lot to the community piece of this too, and to the addictive nature of Americans, I guess, in particular. Maybe it's our post-industrial, maybe we're just bored, right, Sam? Maybe there's just no friction in life anymore. You said that corporate marketers act like drug traffickers and drug traffickers act like corporate marketers.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And it has to do, well, one example of that, of course, is the, in my Dreamland book, I wrote about the Sacklers and this dealers from this one town in Nayarit, Mexico, where everybody sells heroin up in the States like a pizza delivery. I would say that the trafficking, the marketing, you know, is very, very similar. You have to read the full book to understand. But I mean, they understand how you create more market. And that's by plying people with it, making it easy, reducing the friction to use. I knew one guy who was a heroin addict for 30 years, having to buy his heroin every day in a housing project, which was dangerous as hell, or every couple of days. He raised a family, had a painting business, had a generally normal life, except he was addicted to heroin. And then these guys show up in his town, and pretty soon he has lost it all, because it's so much easier to get the dope from them than it ever was by having to go to the housing project, you know? And I would say that that is also the case with all the legal stuff that's now being marketed to us in our lifetimes. This has happened. This is a remarkable idea that I think since the late 90s is where I kind of peg it. It could have been before, where you're finding companies understanding the neuroscience, understanding that they can market their Slurpees or their burgers or their pizza or their gambling apps now as, you know, addictive. And that's good somehow. Somehow that's good.
Well, and you refer to how Wendy's and McDonald's market their hamburgers. And you even describe how, you know, it's this glistening hamburger, right, with the fat coming out and the cheese. And look, I don't know how many I've had in my life, Sam, but you're absolutely right. And, you know, aside from the drugs you're talking about, that stuff that anybody and all of us probably ingest on a daily basis, is there any sort of nastier combination for the human body than salt, fat, and sugar?
That's exactly right. And what's happening now, of course, is you're seeing gambling apps. That's the newest thing. I am frankly appalled. I see these big time athletes who have money. They don't need any more damn money. And yet they are going on TV for marketing gambling apps. This is highly addictive stuff made so by the same thing that the heroin traffickers knew would work that I wrote about in Dreamland. And that is reducing friction to use, making it as easy as possible to use. So now it's on your smartphone and an app begging every time you pick up the phone to be used. I mean, I don't see the difference between marketing heroin to people at a methadone clinic, for example, and marketing gambling on an app. This is going to be another example of supply creating demand, creating addiction.
This is one of the things that you talk about the difference between dopamine, which is one of the reward, but it's the quick reward, right? It makes you feel really good, versus serotonin, which makes you feel content. I don't need more. And, you know, I know there's a show on Hulu called Dope Sick, but we might be dopamine sick in this country, which is everything has to be an immediate gratification. I mean, look, Amazon, Sam, I ordered 3 things on Amazon this morning, right? I know they'll be here by Friday. Right? Is, you know, dog food as deadly as fentanyl? No, but it's the same basic thing, which is like, I know it's going to appear.
Right. And I think that is another way in which I believe we have destroyed community in a lot of ways. We have just made it so that we do not tolerate postponing gratification. And to me, that's a big part of what keeps us alone. We need to be kind of alone in our own addiction, in a sense. We have become a country, I believe very strongly, that is kind of displaying the symptoms of addiction in many, many ways. The gambling apps are just the latest example of that. Sugar is certainly another one. That's why I say traffickers behave like corporations. Corporations behave like traffickers. They all understand, either explicitly or instinctively, that if they make it easy to use, these products by themselves will create their own demand because they are so addictive. And it's the far extreme is an opioid derived from the opium poppy or fentanyl or whatever. But hard to say that the video game is any much different, you know, or Facebook like button or the gambling casino or what have you is any much different than that.
But I think that the antidote to this, literally and figuratively, to your point, seems to be a return to some level of, and you go back through this and some of the people you spoke to, which is, we are social animals. We are not meant to be alone, right? I think one of the people you interviewed said, like, we have Stone Age brains in the 21st century. And so now all of this stuff is sort of scrambling the pathways, whether or not that's pleasure and pain or cognition or whatever it is. But in your story here, and I've found it both heartening and fascinating that so many of the people in these towns that are creating the communities are recovering addicts, that they are folks who are, they have to fight their own fight day in and day out, but now they're turning their experiences into helping folks. And that's also judges from very conservative areas often, police officers, sheriffs from very conservative areas often, who are saying, you know what, throwing these guys in prison, like, you can do that because there is an effect of the detoxification that they need, but long-term prison sentences aren't going to do these guys any good or these gals any good. And so talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing out there that is, you know, the glimmer of hope you mentioned. And I was thinking about this as I was reading your book about Alexis de Tocqueville, which he always was fascinated. Americans, going back to the founding, even beforehand, had this rugged individualism, but matched with this idea of, yes, I'm a rugged individual, but I can't do it by myself.
The community is essential. And I think that's one of the interesting insights of de Tocqueville is that, yeah, individualism's really important. It's like the same thing as the balance between dopamine and serotonin. You need that balance to be a functioning human being. You need the balance between rugged individualism and understanding that you did not create any of this on your own. And yet, increasingly, I think as a country, we've kind of come to believe that I could go it on my own. No, you cannot go it on your own. You cannot.
Because again, there's no friction. Everything appears. Like, I used to work in Sacramento, Sam. I worked in the ballot initiative business, if you can believe it. And one time, this is like 2009, this might be right in the middle of the financial crisis. And somebody said, when do you think things could ever really change? And I said, when you flick the light switch on and nothing happens, when you turn on the water and the spigot doesn't happen, when, you know, you look outside and the garbage hasn't been picked up, right? Like, things will only change when all of the things, and let's be clear, we do take them for granted, Sam, start to, you know, fall apart. Now, do I think we're on the precipice of that? No. But we're certainly on a path that requires, I think, some real reflection and hard work. And I think friction, if there's a word I could use that we all need more of, it's friction.
I couldn't agree more. I think that it's our own prosperity. Think about it this way. I mean, it's our own prosperity that is creating our own demise. It's allowing us to be isolated. And we are seeing rates of depression, suicide, just feeling of anxiety and like a unsettled feeling in the country. So often people like tuning into cable TV news all about inflaming you with outrage. Twitter kind of same thing frequently, that kind of stuff. Now, what I find to be fascinating and what I really took to be a very heartening trend was if you go beyond that, if you dig down below all of that, and it's not hard to do if you spend a little time, you will find that in many parts of the country, that is not the governing ethos. There's a lot of places where people are coming together, finding each other. It's particularly true for some of the reasons you mentioned in areas where they've been hit hardest by the drug addiction epidemic. First, pain pills and heroin and meth and fentanyl and all that kind of stuff, because it's been an emergency for a long time, the same as not being able to turn on the lights might be. This is real stuff. And so what I find fascinating is that on the local level, and I've found several towns where this is going on, where people are coming to understand a few things. First of all, you cannot do it alone. Second of all, it's enormously important because of that to find other personalities like yourself who are energized, wanting to change, seeing things that could change, but you can't do it alone. So let's see if we can find other personalities. And pretty soon, one of these little sparks begin to create synergies that are really kind of interesting on a larger town level, neighborhood level. My last chapter in The Least of Us is about the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, which is a town that's a big part of the Dreamland book. I went back there to see what was going on there. And indeed, that's what's going on. You know, they have four CrossFits now where people are getting together to work out together. They have two outdoor cafes. Now, that is huge. I cannot emphasize enough what I think is the importance of outdoor cafes, not the Starbucks by the interstate. I'm talking about places where people come together frequently outside, at least when the weather's fine. And you meet these meetups. Again, you're talking about these neurons hitting each other, you know, well, these are people hitting up each other and finding new ways of convening.
But it's almost sort of like cosmic dust, right? One little piece sticks and then it spins. And before you know it, you got a sun, right?
It's all about the little steps.
Right. And that's the part, that's the hard part, but that's the part that makes it worth it.
I agree. And that's what my book is titled, The Least of Us. In part, that's because from Matthew, book of Matthew in the Bible, Jesus said, that's what you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do it to me. That is part of it. But it's also, you know, it's the least little effort, the smallest effort, the effort that seems pointless is actually the effort that leads to down the road, larger social change that is really impactful, solid, and does not come with the unintended consequences of these magical answers that we believe we all are entitled to, like no more pain. And so doctors give every single human being one very highly addictive pain pill, thinking that it won't addict anybody. You know, that kind of bizarreness.
Or it's like, what's the root cause of this pain? Maybe we should solve that. Or, you know, you go to your average CVS, Sam, and there is an entire aisle of diabetes-related stuff.
And, you know, the other thing is, look at the marijuana industry now. It's mood. It's about mood change. And we can take this little CBD or this little pill or this gummy or whatever, and our mood, which I've seen it marketed that way. Again, this is all very toxic marketing, in my opinion, very damaging marketing. And in some of these towns, you hear people say, no, we don't need that. We need a factory. Yeah, that was in the 50s. That was in the 70s.
Right. Those worlds aren't coming back.
But the point is, we don't get to real social change without these small, small steps by lots of people coming out, realizing what was wrong. I can do something. It just isn't going to be saving the world in some virtuous way. I want to tell you, I was just in the town of Hazard, Kentucky. Hazard, Kentucky is known in eastern Kentucky, middle of Appalachia, as the, what can we call it? The buckle on the opioid belt of Kentucky. I mean, just a place that was just ravaged by departure of coal, major employer for a long time, now really not. And then, of course, the pills come in catastrophic quantities, never a problem with addiction in these areas. And then the pills create it, and then all of a sudden, Kentucky's second or third in the country. Same happened in West Virginia. You know, no problem with addiction in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And now the pills come in and all of a sudden, boom, it's again, a supply creating demand. But in Hazard, they've gone through this devastation of like a generation or two. And what you find now, downtown Hazard has 42 new businesses. And from that have grown 140 new jobs. Now, that would seem to me, okay, every business is creating two jobs, three jobs. What does that matter? Yeah, it does matter. It's huge. It's fundamental. Because all those businesses are coming together. They're finding each other. All these people are finding each other. And the people involved And the townspeople in Hazard are the ones supporting. There's no tourism to Hazard, Kentucky. There's no big freeway in which people just get right off and spend a lot of money and leave. This is all people locally creating this. And this is creating a petri dish of fascinating energies.
You called it microcapitalism.
That's exactly what it is. It's very much punk rock. I used to be involved in, I love punk rock. It's all about do it yourself. Nobody's coming and you could do it on your own. And it's a wonderfully American, getting back to what de Tocqueville was talking about. You have rugged individualism combined with a community sense that is essential to how we get out of this. And again, many of those, as you were saying earlier, many of the owners are in recovery from drug addiction, and many of the employees are as well. People are understanding that we have a raw material, a new resource, energy derived from decay. That's the recovering addict. Like, think of it like this. I've come to think of it like it's the new coal. Without the black lung, the strip mines, and the ownership that lives in New York or Chicago and tells you how to run your state.
But I think that there's a component to that, too, that I think we should also, we shouldn't overlook, Sam, which is there's a perseverance that's required, too, because so many of these folks who are battling this, some of them will fail. Some of them will fail and will die. In fact, two of the guys that you talked about who were sort of beacons of hope after recovery, it's sort of a heartbreak at the end of the book. They didn't make it.
No, they did not. It's a very sad thing. I miss both those guys, Billy Deaver in Portsmouth, Ohio, and Big Will Pefferman in Kenton County, Kentucky. Both those guys were brilliant, very articulate, very committed, and both taken down by fentanyl, which came in other drugs. For them, they were not using fentanyl. They were not using heroin. They just relapsed, I think, into cocaine. I'm not sure exactly in both cases, but fentanyl was in what they eventually used. Very sad.
So there's a lot of heartbreak in this book, Sam, and a lot of heartbreak in the stories you tell, but there's enough hope, right? There's enough green shoots in there, right, to give us something to hold on to, not only in these towns, but I think for all of us. But, you know, it's been a couple of years since the book came out. What else have you seen out there? What else is worrying you? What else is making you feel good? What else should we focus on so that in our ways, which may be nothing, maybe a little bit, maybe something we didn't even think of, what else is out there for you?
I would say a couple of things. Some of these things very ominous and some of them really very positive. You know, you may have heard that fentanyl is now being mixed with xylazine, which is a veterinarian sedative, a horrible thing to mix fentanyl with. That is simply a continuation of the trafficking world's move into synthetic drugs. Now, you can put just any damn thing, and it may be that xylazine worsens withdrawals, making it far more difficult for people to actually quit using your drug, which would make it a benefit if you're a trafficker, a diabolical idea, but nevertheless. And so I'm finding that. I'm also finding that we still as a country have not come to understand that one of the reasons Mexican traffickers are producing these drugs with such ridiculous impunity down in Mexico is because of the assault weapons that are bought here and smuggled south. It's an amazing idea, but it's true that our assault weapon ban ended in 2004, and the big time trafficking wars that erupted in Mexico began the next year and have gotten worse progressively ever since. And they use those guns to govern, I mean, and create their own impunity. We are arming the very people who are killing us. It's a bizarre idea, and we need to understand it's because those guns are going south in such enormous quantities, dribbling south in small amounts, but daily, all the time, and with huge amounts of ammunition as well.
And look, we see on the news the destruction it wreaks down there, and we see it in our own schools here.
Of course, yeah. Every 2 weeks, there's a schoolyard shooting or what have you. You know, all of that is really due to, there's a lot of factors, but definitely the impunity in Mexico that these traffickers enjoy is ensured by the guns that we allow people to smuggle south.
Don't you think the impunity, though, in this country, too, is a problem? You mentioned one of the vignettes in your book is about this woman, Joss Sackler, who's married to one of the Sackler heirs. And she puts on this like ridiculous performance art thing in Brooklyn. And they have no capacity, to your point about how some of these addicts lose empathy, these people have no capacity to understand that they're responsible for so much.
I would agree with that. And I think that's, again, a function of how insulated and wealthy and prosperous they have been for so long. The Sackler family got used to being applauded in very, very soft journalistic accounts for their charity and philanthropy, which is admittedly quite remarkable. I would never suggest otherwise, but there's another part to that story. And I think that they just, through their own prosperity, kind of got separated from the rest of America. So now if it's not in Vail, Colorado, or London, or the Hamptons in New York City, they were not part of the country, you know? And to me, that feels like the way we generally have become, and we're not all of us Sacklers, but so much of us have kind of separated from each other to the point where we don't quite understand other people around us, you know? And all of that is kind of part of what we need to get away from.
I think it's an unhealthy curation of our own lives, right?
That's a good way of putting it. I think we have picked the things to surround ourselves with that make sure that we don't have any friction by dealing with other people who we don't like. Because why? Well, they don't vote like we do. I'm out of touch with humans, so I don't know how to deal with them when they say stuff that I don't understand or don't like or whatever. You know, that kind of thing. It's all part of this larger isolation. I would say, though, as I said before, that some of the really beautiful stuff, you ask me what's positive out there, I think these stories of these small towns understanding that they can't do it alone, like de Tocqueville suggested, that they need each other, that they have a raw material, the new coal, as I say, is these recovering addicts who bring, it's the same body, but a different mind. And that means they bring gratitude, creativity, energy, optimism, all of which is about creating new possibilities in a town where for decades, there was no new possibilities. And it was all about the inertia and fatalism of dope, you know. I think that is an exciting thing. And that's why focusing on the small stuff, not expecting that someone's going to come and save you, or not expecting that you can do it alone, and not expecting you're saving the world by your small little effort. All of this is so important to understand. And that's really the major theme of The Least of Us. And it began when I was writing Dreamland, but I expanded on it significantly in The Least of Us. It's about Americans. Half the book is really about Americans in the smallest way possible, engaged in the recovery, the strengthening, the repairing of community and wherever they live.
Well, listen, Sam, I want to thank you so much for joining me. This has been, for me, a conversation I've wanted to have for a long time, so I appreciate you making the time. Is there anywhere that our listeners can find you online on social media if you choose to be there, or where they can find your work?
Sure. Any author, I guess, has to be on social media, so I'm everywhere on that stuff. But they can go to my website, samquinones.com. You can find my email. I'm very easy to find that way. I'm on Facebook at Sam Quinones Journalist, Twitter, SamQuinones7, and Instagram, SamQuinones_author. And as you say, you can buy my books, you know, on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble.
Or how about a local bookstore?
A local bookstore, bookshelf has them, all that kind of stuff. So feel free to support your local bookstore. I try to do those every chance I get. But yeah, very easy.
Well, Sam, as always, thank you. As always, gang, you can find me on Twitter and TikTok at Reed Galen, on Instagram at Reed_Galen_LP. Sam Quinones, thank you so much. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter at Project Lincoln. And for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.